This podcast is a production of Crosspoint Church. Visit us online at crosspointwithane.org.
That was awesome. Wow. Very cool. Well, as always, our ushers are going to come forward now and just give us another chance just to continue to worship and trust in God with our finances. So if you want to worship God through giving and trusting Him in a tangible way, I invite you to go ahead and do that now. Also want to let you know, as you can see, hopefully from our stage, today's Kids Space Day. And so we're excited about that around here. Kids Space starts at, we can get excited about Kids Space. It's an event we do a few times a year with the goal and intent of bringing parents and kids together. And it's a program focused on elementary age school students and under. And so our goal is to create an environment where parents and kids come together and we can equip parents to begin to have spiritual conversations with their kids in a very fun and creative and energetic way to bring families together. And so that starts at 4 o'clock today, and you are all welcome, and you can bring friends, family, whoever you'd like. If it's raining, we'll still have it. Everything that we'll have will be inside if it's raining, so that's not a problem at all. So 4 o'clock, that starts today. We'd love to have you here. Also, wanted to remind you that Craig Gross, who's the founder and pastor of XXXChurch.com, he is going to be here at our church July 1st. And so I wrote about that in an email out to everyone this past week. And if you don't get that email and you'd like to, you can fill that out on the Connect card and just my regular communication with everybody. Or you can read more details about it if you go to our website at crosspoint.org and click on the pastor's note. A lot of details are in there. I invite you to go back and read. But XXXChurch is an incredible ministry. And what they're focused on is they're focused on addressing the issue of pornography in our culture and coming alongside and helping people who struggle with it. And Craig has spoken at some of the most influential churches in the country, and he's just highly sought after, actually all across the world. He's been recently featured on with Anderson Cooper and with CNN and with Katie Kirk and CBS Evening News and Good Morning America. And so a lot of people have been featuring him and talking about what they're doing, what they're going after. And so we are just so extremely blessed. We've been working on this for several months that Craig is going to be here. I talked to him yesterday, and he's just really excited about being here with us on July 1st. So definitely mark that down. We'll talk more about that, but wanted to let you know well in advance. Well, today we are wrapping up this latest series of teachings we've been in called Love Affair. And if this is your first week here, I'd encourage you to go back and maybe listen to the others on the podcast. You can get all the messages for free through iTunes and just hit Crosspoint Church in the search engine, and you'll find all our messages there. Once you subscribe, you can get them on podcast and get them on CD. Because we've covered a lot of ground the last several weeks in different aspects of relationships. We've looked at what it means to be fully single, and we've looked at what it means, this idea that God is for us, that He's for us in regards to our sexuality. We explored marriage, and then last week we talked about divorce, and we dissected why it is that God hates it. And at the same time, we confronted why in many places, historically, the church in general has confused God's disdain for divorce to also include disdain for the divorcee, and where people sometimes take Jesus' words out of context oftentimes, and they look at people who have suffered through the pain of divorce, and they look at them like they have this scarlet letter on their chest. And so we looked at why that's contrary to the scriptures and why that's contrary to the way of Jesus. And all of that brings us to today. And what I want to do today is fairly simple. Last several weeks, I know the messages that have stirred a lot of conversations. I've had conversations with many of you. Steve and I both have. I've heard stories about many conversations in gel groups and in your neighborhoods and in your homes and in marriages. And so what I'd like to do this morning is I just want to give you one kind of final thought to hang on to, one final principle that if you're married or you're thinking about getting married or you just hope to get married someday, that if you could let this one idea soak in, that it will help your marriage significantly, make it over a lifetime. It'll make it over the long haul. And not only make it, but this principle I really believe can help make it awesome and keep it, as the song says, from running dry over time. This last week on Monday morning, I walked into the office and was going through various notes and messages, and I came across this one that somehow made its way to me. And it's in reference to the message that Steve taught last week on divorce. And here's what it says.
It says, you say there is no scarlet letter because you're divorced. Yet Crosspoint has decided that anyone who is divorced can't be an elder. I know the scriptural references. Here is food for thought. It takes two people to make a marriage. It only takes one person to get a divorce. You assume that anyone who is divorced is responsible for the divorce. So, a few observations in regards to this particular note. One, now I'm confident that this was just an oversight, but somehow this person forgot to write their name. You know? Somehow they left it unsigned. And even though there's this great open space at the bottom, you know, perfectly large space, plenty of room for them to write it, somehow they forgot. Two, surprisingly, I'm not aware at all of the decision that this person is referring to, that he or she bases their accusation on. In fact, in the short time that we did actually address this issue a while back when we studied the scriptures, we actually came to the opposite conclusion, that scripture teaches that divorce is not a disqualifier for any type of leadership in the church. In fact, during my announcements about elders just several weeks ago, I had someone come up to me in a very appropriate way out in the lobby and said, can you be an elder here and be divorced here at Crosspoint? And I said, yeah, you can. That's not a disqualifier for you. And so I went on to explain the scriptural reference sometimes that people get hung up to where Paul is writing to Timothy and he talks about different requirements, Timothy and Titus, and the different requirements for an elder. And where one of them, he says that a requirement for an elder is to be the husband of one wife. And so people take that kind of out of context. But when you look at the original language and you kind of unpack that, what he's referring to in this culture of polygamy that they're in is that the intent of the language that Paul uses there in the Greek is that you're committed to the wife that you have. That's the intent of the verse. And so I was like, yeah, that's what Paul means there. And so I'm not sure of the basis of this accusation because we've actually landed on the opposite end. Thirdly, I don't know how someone could listen to the message last week that Steve just did an awesome job on and come to this point where you can say you assume that anyone who is divorced is responsible for the divorce and just putting all this blame on one individual. But last observation, though. In reading the note, it illustrated this very basic truth that really has permeated this entire series of teaching. And it's this, that learning how to love has to be instructed over and over and over again. It just has to. But you see, in contrast, things like frustration and anger and disappointment and disgust, I mean, those things never need any instruction, do they? I mean, you don't have to be taught about how to do those things. The only thing that they need in order to happen is to be provoked. They don't have to be taught. They just merely need to be provoked. But you see, love is different. We continually have to be instructed over and over again on how to love. And yes, even in the church, and even in great churches like ours, where we can easily forget that. And at times, people can find themselves, kind of lobbing these anonymous accusation bombs over the wall, or these anonymous voicemails over the wall, rather than saying, you know what, hey, I've heard something, and I've got a concern. Can we talk about it? Can we begin a discussion on that? Because I'm seeking to understand. Friends, I just want to let you know, that's how all of us should do life around here. It's how all of us should do life. It's how we should interact with one another on this journey that we're called on together, because it's how Jesus instructs us to do it. And so understand, whether it's an issue with me, and trust me, I am fine with criticism. You can talk to our staff. It is a high value on our staff that we have very open and honest communication, but that it's also marked in love. What we do and the mission that we're on is far too critical to not have open and honest communication. But there's a right way to do it, and there's a wrong way to do it. And we are so blessed around here that, you know, notes like these and, you know, voicemails that we'll get at times are, they're a rarity. But we need to understand that whether it's me or with another leader here at our church or with just one another and how we treat one another on this group of people that have come together on this mission, on this journey, we need to be reminded over and over again on how to love, because we all forget that. We forget it. And it's not just with our church, but it can be with our neighbors, it can be with our coworkers, it can be with our bosses, it can be with our families. And sometimes the mistake that we make is this faulty way of thinking that love should just come natural. That it should just come natural to us. But it doesn't. You have to instruct it over and over again. This last week, my youngest son, Trace, turned 3. And so after he went to bed, my wife and I went into his room and we placed all these balloons in his room, and so that when he would wake up, he would see, these balloons. And so the next morning, about 6:15, which was way too early, all of a sudden we hear, Mommy, Daddy. And so Ader and I, kind of groggy, we wake up and we go into his room. And Trace, he goes, "Look, I got birthday balloons." He's like, "I'm 3, And he was so pumped. And I was like, "Well, I know, Mom and Dad got those for you," because I didn't want some balloon fairy getting the credit or something for giving my son balloons. I was like, "Yeah, Mom and Dad got you those." And we're all sitting there and we're celebrating. We're having this moment. And all of a sudden, our 5-year-old Caden walks in the room. And we had thought Caden was still asleep and still sleeping in his room. And all of a sudden, he walks in with this little sign, with this little poster, where he had written on it in marker, "Trace, I love you, Caden." And that's exactly what we did. And so we're all just like, "Oh, this is great." And so Adrian, she looks over at me and she's like, did you do that with him? Did you help him do that?" And I was like, "I didn't say anything to him. I don't know where in the world that happened." And so then it was like a real, you did this on your own. And so we like forgot all about Trace. And so we're hugging Caden and we're like, "Oh, buddy, I'm so proud of you. We just love you so much. And this is such a great job," because we were just so happy. We're like, our kids are finally getting it, and we try to instruct them on love over and over again and be like, "You guys are best friends, and you guys need to learn how to love one another." And so we're just like on this kind of parental high thinking, "Oh yeah, our kids are finally getting it." So we go downstairs to start getting breakfast ready. And just a couple minutes later, all of a sudden there's this screaming upstairs, And so we run upstairs and there's Caden with this balloon just beating his brother's head with it, And Trace is screaming, "I want my balloon," And Caden's just wailing on him, And so we're like, "All right, yeah, toss that whole 'our kids got it' thing," And we're back to instructing over and over again. And that's where we were, because understand, instructing how to love, it just never stops. And please understand, that's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing, because learning how to love is, and being committed to learning how to love, is a critical lifelong process. A follower of Jesus, he wrote this in a book called 1 John later on in the New Testament. He writes, "Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another." Now notice, that's not a suggestion. That's an instruction. It's a command that you ought to love one another. He goes on, "No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us." And that word "lives" there, it carries this meaning of abiding and dwelling and remaining. God remains in us, and his love is made complete in us. And so when you step back for a moment and you see the bigger picture, learning how to love is one of the core ways, foundational ways, that God draws us closer to himself, that we enter into a more intimate, close relationship with God. And learning how to love is the way that God uses to shape us into the people he desires us to be. And so in light of that, as we wrap up this love affair series today, there's just one more foundational principle that I want us to learn. And for many of us, this is just simply a matter of being reminded. Because I'll tell you up front, it's a principle that makes sense. It's something we all should know. In fact, many of us have claimed to know it from the very first day we were married. But somewhere along the way, maybe when difficult times came, somehow, somewhere, we lost track and we forgot. And the beauty of this principle that we're going to land on this morning is that it not only applies to marriage, but it really transcends all of our relationships. And at the very heart of what we're going to look at today is this idea of commitment. Now, oftentimes you'll hear people talk about how the problem in most relationships today is this lack of commitment. You hear people complain, "Well, he's just not committed," or "she's not committed." Or, we look at another couple and we're like, "If they could just understand commitment, then everything would be fine." People say, "Oh, that's the issue with people today. Nobody wants to commit to anything." But in my observation of people, in my observation of the world, I don't think that's necessarily true most of the time. I think the reality is that most of us know how to commit. I think most of us are very commitment-type people. In fact, I think the majority of us are extremely committed people. But here's the problem. Many times the issue isn't that we're not committed. The issue is that we get committed to the wrong thing. That's the issue. And far too often, that's exactly what happens in marriage. And many times, people don't even realize it. People don't even realize that they've committed to the wrong thing. And so they find themselves at this spot where they're continually frustrated, where they feel like they're in this seemingly insurmountable impasse in their relationship. And it doesn't mean that the relationship's terrible. Maybe it's just stale. Maybe they've just found themselves where they've hit this wall emotionally or relationally, and they're starting to have all these doubts and they're starting to have all these questions because things just seem to be getting progressively worse or just kind of at a standstill. And they're starting to ask questions and think, well, what's it going to be like a month from now? What's it going to be like 5 years from now or 10 years from now if things continue in this way? And friends, over and over again, that's what happens when people get committed to the wrong thing. So this last week, I checked out for a while down out of the office and went down to Panera to write some the message. Sometimes it's easier for me just to get out of an environment and go someplace else. And so I just started writing down, you know, some of the things that I've noticed and I've experienced in my own marriage where we can get committed to the wrong things and what those are. Now, for many of us, while we wouldn't say it this way, what we really get committed to in marriage is me. Now, okay, not me personally. That would be weird, you know? That's like the red Kool-Aid cult kind of thing, you know? So not getting committed to me, but what happens is we get committed to ourselves. We get committed to what we think we deserve, where we have these certain expectations. And if our expectations aren't met, then we get frustrated and we start to check out. We start to withdraw. And it might be, you know, in little ways at first, but over time, those little ways begin to escalate and then the tension begins to build. And the tension keeps building because deep down, you really expect her, even though you've never said it, maybe you've never verbalized it, but what you really expect of her is you expect her to be like your mom. And when she doesn't wait on you hand and foot, and she doesn't treat you exactly like your mom did, then frustrates you because you have this unspoken expectation that this is how she should act. Maybe walls start building up and keep building up because you keep wondering why he can't be more like the guy in your romance novels. The novels that you keep reading and you're just wondering, why can't he be more like that? Or why can't he be like that one guy in my office? The one who always seems to notice you, the one who always seems to compliment you, the one who always knows when you get your hair cut or when you have a new outfit. Or perhaps you just keep withdrawing, and that tension just keeps building because you know what? She can never compare to the fantasies that are in your head, where you have these images that have been burned inside your mind because you've exposed yourself to certain images and fantasies in magazines or in videos or on the internet. And so as a result, she is always failing to meet up with your unrealistic expectations that you hold on to on the way she should act or things that she should do or how she should respond. Or maybe you find yourself withdrawing because the reality is you're just so frustrated because you keep expecting him to be more than he is. And it doesn't matter if he wasn't that way when you married him. You've just placed your expectations on him that he can't ever seem to live up to. You have these expectations. Again, they might not be communicated, but maybe they are. You have these expectations he can never live up to as a provider in your eyes, as a leader in your home, maybe as a spiritual leader in your home. And so you make it very clear in your body language or with your tone, if not with your words, how constantly disappointed you are in him. And the tension builds. And the walls get built up. Friends, understand, all expectations aren't wrong. The problem is that when we commit to our expectations. And to make it even worse, most of our expectations are unrealistic. Most of them are unspoken. And the vast majority of them are very unfair. I talked to a guy a while back who was backing out of his engagement over a very minor disagreement with his fiance. I mean, I had walked through with this couple for a while, and I couldn't believe it. couldn't believe that he was checking out on this, and it was ridiculous, frankly. And here was his reasoning. His reasoning was, the reason I loved her, the reason I loved her and was committed to her was I thought she was everything my ex wasn't. Yeah, exactly. And now that this has come up, now that this issue has come up, you know what? I'm not so sure. And here's what he said. I want to make sure that there are no surprises before I commit. And I was like, brother, if you don't want surprises, then why don't you just get yourself a cat, you know? That's what you're committed to. Because they're going to come. You need to see. And I told him, your expectations are way too unrealistic. They're way too unfair for someone to live under that kind of microscope all the time. That's what happens. That's what happens when we commit to our expectations. And we cling to those and we hold on to those. Something else you see all the time people get committed to is this idea of being in love. And you see, when that's what we get committed to, when we don't feel that way anymore, we consider ourselves free to check out. Because after all, if I signed up for marriage because I was in love and now I'm not anymore, I don't feel that way anymore, the natural conclusion then is to get out of the marriage because what I committed to, what I committed to being in, is no longer around. And friends, when you have that understanding, when you have that mindset, when you have that commitment, it is a very dangerous slope that it takes people down in their reasoning. And this is how it goes. I see this play out all the time. Here's the way of thinking and how it progresses. They say, well, if this person was my soulmate, which is a whole other message, but the idea of a soulmate is an unbiblical idea anyway. But again, that's something else. But if this person was my soulmate, then I should always feel in love. And since I don't always feel in love, then I conclude that this person must not really be my soulmate because they don't make me feel this certain way all the time. Which leads to the conclusion, well then, my soulmate must still be out there somewhere because obviously this person isn't it. And so people stand at a crossroads. And the crossroads that they face then is, one, do I just check out and go find my soulmate so I can experience this feeling that I'm so committed to that I'm supposed to have with somebody because after all, that's the goal, to have this feeling. Or do I just suffer through for the rest of my life with this painful longing for someone else? You see what happens when we wrongly get committed to a feeling or an emotion, whether it's in love, as that's what we call the feeling, or happiness, and when we don't feel it or we don't get it, we assume we're better off trying to find it someplace else. Linda Waite is a sociology professor at the University of Chicago, and she's done a lot of research in this area. She wrote a book several years ago called The Case for Marriage. And in it, she did this study called, Does Divorce Make People Happy? And there's some amazing, amazing research that she found here. And here's what she found. Nearly 80% of all couples who rated themselves as very unhappy, as feeling very unhappy, but stayed together, rated themselves 5 years later as happily married. 80%. Now, conversely, spouses who considered themselves very unhappily married and went ahead and got divorced and had to go through custody battles and hardships and loneliness and future romantic disappointments and so on, only 19% of them rated themselves as happy 5 years later. And in it, she writes that this idea that divorce is the ticket for happiness is a setup for enormous failure for so many people. But you see, that's why so many people check out in big ways like divorce and even check out in more subtle ways like emotionally. Because what happens is people get committed to a feeling. A feeling which by design ebbs and flows throughout the course of time, depending on mood, depending on circumstances, depending on things that are happening to you. Feelings by design go up and down. You know, another commitment I see individuals make in marriage is this often very unspoken commitment to just keep peace. Where the main commitment that couples make or individuals make is just to keep things stable and not rock the boat too much. And people get committed to avoiding conflict at all cost. And when one or both individuals make that commitment, what often happens is that the relationship never moves past a very surface level. It never does. See, oftentimes people have this great fear of conflict that they think, you know what, conflict is this terrible thing and a healthy marriage shouldn't have any conflict at all. But just not reality. That healthy marriages have conflict. And when you're committed to avoiding it, oftentimes this great fear that causes that, the result is that genuine feelings and emotions and concerns and the real you never gets shared. All those things get stuffed down inside. And so what happens is you have two people that get committed to pretending. To pretending with one another. And that results in people being tempted to lie all the time. You know, I've got to lie because I've got to cover up the truth, or can't say the whole truth. I can't live in the world of reality of what's actually going on, because if I do, then this one spouse may blow up and things are going to be tense. And, you know, it's just going to be awkward all around the house. And so it's better off that I just pretend. It's just better off that I lie. In the same vein, what happens when you kind of play this forward, spouses over time become unwilling to commit to confronting certain destructive patterns of behavior. And they do so out of fear, which leads to even more damage in the relationship long term, because they don't want to confront the behavior that's just damaging that person or damaging the relationship. They don't want to confront it in love, and so they just avoid it. Because what they get committed to is peace. And in trying to do so, what they don't realize and what we don't realize when we do that is we forfeit the potential for the very thing that makes marriage such a wonderful gift. We forfeit the very thing that people long for in marriage. This ability, the way God designed it, to be completely known by another person. To be completely known, warts and failures and all. To be able to be completely you with no masks and still be loved. But if your main commitment is to peace, it'll never happen. It'll never get you there. But perhaps the commitment that I hear the most is this commitment that many times derails couples without them ever realizing it. And here's why. Because at first, it sounds right. And at first, it sounds like a good thing. In fact, it even sounds like an honorable thing. Where you find people over and over again, this is what they get committed to. You hear them say this: you know what? I'm committed to the marriage. I'm committed to the marriage. And I know there's some of you who probably hear that and say, well, wait a second, isn't that right? I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to be committed to? But you see, what can happen over time when that's people's mindset, when that's people's main commitment, is commitment to the marriage? That can translate into, you know what, I'm simply committed to staying under the same roof. Because you know what, I don't want to be known as a quitter. So no matter how hard it gets, no matter how bad it gets, I'm going to stick it out. Doesn't mean that I have to engage emotionally. Doesn't mean I have to engage relationally. All that I've committed to is I'm committed to not walking out that door because I don't want to be known as a quitter. Because I'm committed to the marriage. Sometimes the reasoning goes like this. Well, you know what we're committed to? We're committed to the marriage for the sake of the kids. Maybe you've heard that. Maybe you've experienced that. Maybe that's where you're at. Whenever I talk to couples and I hear that, we're committed to the marriage for the sake of the kids, I always challenge them and say, okay, well, what's that mean after the kids leave the house? Does it mean it's okay to divorce them? Because I'm telling you, from my experience and from talking to, you know, hundreds of students and seeing this play out in so many families, hundreds and hundreds of families, divorce is painful no matter what age your kids are. Doesn't matter if they're in the home. Doesn't matter if they've already, you know, are out of the home. It's painful and it rips families apart. And you have to ask yourself, is that the kind of example I want to set for my kids of what marriage should be? Just hang in there. Hang in there for 20 years or so, unhappily. Suffer through it for the sake of your kids. And then you can get divorced. Then you can check out. And then face the reality of loneliness and trying to start over your life in middle-aged years. Is that the example that you want to put for them? If here's what marriage is like? Because I'm not really sure that's in the best interest of the kids. See, here's the bottom line with this. when what you're committed to is a marriage, if that marriage doesn't go the way you want it to, or if it doesn't look like the way you think it should, the implication of that reasoning and the implication of that commitment is that you can always go find another marriage. Do you see that distinction? Because after all, that's what you're committed to. You're committed to the marriage. Now, it's taken us a while to get there, but here's where all this is going. If you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Mark, chapter 10. Mark's the second book in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mark, chapter 10. If you don't have a Bible, I'd be happy to put the words on the screen behind me so you can follow along with this. And I want us to notice, this is a very simple thought, very simple principle, but it's so critical. I want you to notice what Jesus says in reference to marriage. And he starts off here in Mark 10, verse 7, by quoting from God all the way back in the book of Genesis. Mark chapter 10, verse 7. It says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate." Okay, here's the deal. When it comes to learning how to love in marriage, when it comes to what it means, how do I pursue oneness over a lifetime? How do I be able to look back and see, you know what, it's better now than it was last year, and it was better than it was 2 years ago? How do we pursue more oneness and more intimacy with one another over the course of a lifetime? When it comes to learning how to do that, it starts at its core with this understanding that your commitment, that your foundational commitment that you make isn't to being in love. That the foundational commitment that you have to make isn't to having your expectations met or your needs met. It isn't a commitment to keep the peace. It's not even about being committed to a marriage. At its core, look at what Jesus says there. He says, it's about united from the very beginning. From the very beginning, it's about being united to your spouse. It's about being committed to that unique individual, to your spouse. That is the commitment that you make. And understand, whether you realize it or not, when you stood up before friends, when you stood up in front of your family, when you stood up in front of a judge or a magistrate, regardless of what it is, you stood up before them and you stood in the presence of God. And when you were married, it's exactly what you committed to. Is you committed at that moment not to a marriage. That's not what you vowed to. That's not what you made a commitment to. Not to a marriage. You made a vow and you made a commitment to a person. To a person. I did the exact same thing when I was married 9 years ago next week. When I stood before my family and my friends in the presence of God, and I looked at my wife and I said, "I take you, Adrian, to be my wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish as long as we both shall live." I vowed, and those of you that are married vowed, those of you who hope to be married someday, you'll vow to love and to cherish, not a marriage, but a person. And notice, nothing in the vows we make in a wedding, nothing in them are about what we expect to get from the other person. Nothing in them is about what our benefit will be, what our reward will be, what our payoff will be. We don't commit, we don't promise to get anything out of it. Rather, the vows that we make, the most solemn of vows that we profess and we make, are focused on what we're going to give to this unique individual. And what we vow and what we promise is not dependent on what they do. It's not dependent on an if and then statement. If you do this, then I will do this. Now, hear me on this. Let's not rip it out of context of what we also talked about last week. You know, that we're not, this isn't a case of saying, okay, well, let's take all that way to abuse and to, you know, severe abandonment, all that stuff. Don't rip it out of the context that we talked about last week. But regardless, the vow that you make is one that you make to another person, not dependent on their behavior. There are no if-thens. And so, friends, what could happen? What could happen if we let ourselves be reminded of that and let ourselves be instructed of that truth that perhaps some of us may have forgotten over time? And where you look at your spouse today, if you're married, and if you're not, you just let this principle drill down into your heart, that you look at them and say, you know what, today I'm going to recommit myself to you. To you. I'm not recommitting myself to our marriage. I'm not recommitting myself to some institution, but I'm committing myself to you. That I'm going to stand by you, not stand by this marriage, but by you. You are the one that I vowed before God to love and to cherish. And so the way that that translates to us is we get committed to a person. And so we don't bash that person. We don't talk negatively about them, you know, with our friends or with our neighbors or with our coworkers. And we just kind of, you know, undermine them all the time and just joke about them in just inappropriate ways under this banner of, well, of course I'm committed to the marriage. I'm not going anywhere. See, you don't do that when you're committed to the person. When you're committed to the person, your main thought is, how can I serve this person that I vowed? I vowed to serve. I vowed to give. Not what I vowed to get in return. This is the person I vowed to serve. And so we ask ourselves the same question we talked about a few weeks ago, where we over and over again say, God, how can I love my spouse today like he or she has never been loved before? God, would you shape me into a servant, into this selfless person who is seeking after you and whose response to your love for me, and it gets translated into this person that I love and that I serve because I'm committed to them. I'm committed to the person. And you see, the beauty of that is, again, it translates into all sorts of different relationships. That's why God, in his just sovereignty and his perfect knowledge, he uses this marriage metaphor all the time throughout the New Testament and describe our relationships with churches and with him. Because again, so many people, they get mistaken. They get committed to a church. They get committed to a building. They get committed to an institution. Some of you, you know, even within a group, what happens is you think about your gel group and you get committed to your group. Where you, that means in your mind, well, I show up on time or I just show up every week. Or you're saying, I'm committed to Crosspoint. I'm committed to my church because I show up there on every Sunday. You see, the commitment that we make on this mission that we go on together, this journey that we go on together, isn't a building. It's to one another. We make a commitment to one another, to the journey together, to love one another. It's the same way with God. So many times people, what they get committed to is they get committed to a religion and they wonder, why do I have this huge impasse with God? Why do I just, you know, emotionally and relationally just come at this impasse with him? And it's because we get committed to Christianity. We get committed to a set of morals. We get committed to this idea of Christianity again, rather than our commitment, understanding that we commit to God. We commit to Jesus. We get committed to a person. I love what Henry Cloud writes, an author. He says, we need to stop looking for the spouse we want and start loving the spouse we have. Friends, what if we could embrace that one idea today? If we could do that, it would change so much. Change so much if we could understand these wrong things that we get committed to and that we could say, you know what, today is the day I put a stake in the ground and I'm going to say to my spouse, you know what, I'm going to stand by you. It might not even be a spouse that we know yet, but we say, you know what, I'm committed to you. So in the choices that I make now, I realize that someday there might be a person out there that I commit myself to. And so I'm going to make choices through that window, through that lens. And so friends, to come together today for all of us to say, if you want to figure out how to see a marriage last a lifetime, to pursue oneness with one another over the long haul, it doesn't start with a commitment to say, you know what, well, I'll stick it out. It doesn't start with a commitment to say, well, I'll just hang in there with the kids. It doesn't start with a commitment to a marriage. What it starts with at its core, at its foundation, is a commitment to a person to say, I will stand by you through thick and thin, no matter how difficult it gets. I'm committed to you because it's to you in the presence of God that I bowed and committed myself to. Let me pray for us. God, I thank you so much for the truth of your word. And God, how even sometimes the most simplest of truths that so many of us have heard. God, I know many people in this room, they've heard that verse in weddings that they've attended. They've probably even heard it in their own wedding. This idea that for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. And God, I pray that that principle of not getting committed to a person, but that you unite us with a person, that that is what we commit to, not to a marriage, but to a person. God, that principle, that truth, it would profoundly shape the way that we think. God, that today walls would start to come down. People would start to get honest with one another. And they would commit themselves to each other. And God, it would be a beautiful, beautiful picture of your love that you have for us. So God, would you change lives today? Would you change marriages? Would you change relationships in a radical way? And we pray this in the name of Jesus.